to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey. This is episode number 809. I'm in Libertyville, Illinois, back with a good group of folks to talk about some important Presbyterian history and theology. We're on the heels still of General Assembly season. There may still be some churches meeting, at least as we're recording, there are. The RPCNA Synod, as was mentioned, is still in swing, but at least in terms of the OPC and the PCA, the two that I attended, those are all wrapped up. And so I'm slowly recovering and looking forward to having a good conversation today on the heels of those assemblies. Although by the time that people listen to this, it's going to be a couple weeks later. Nevertheless, let me introduce to you our regular. We have Jim Cassidy, who is the pastor of South Austin OPC in South Austin, Texas. Jim, how are you doing?
I'm melting, Camden. I'm absolutely melting. And we are in the middle of a brutal heat wave right now, and I'm just praying that the Texas electric grid holds.
79 degrees here in northern Illinois. These are the times of years now where our roles are reversed, because in January, late January especially, early February, you were, you know, telling me or mocking me and asking me why in the world I live in the Midwest in northern Illinois, which isn't as bad as it could be further north in Wisconsin or Minnesota, those types of places. But these are the seasons where I'm the happy guy, and you're having
indeed
a rough time. I'm glad I can go outside. So hopefully you'll recover and your power doesn't go down and you die, because that would be sad.
Thanks for your well wishes, brother.
How are the moon towers doing in Austin?
Yeah, they're coming down one by one, I think. But
really?
Yeah, there's a couple still left.
But they're surviving the heat?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they haven't melted yet. No.
Impervious. Well, we're happy to have you with us all the way from Texas. We're also very happy to have with us from the great state of Tennessee, of where I was just last week, Sean Morris, Associate Minister of Covenant PCA in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. He also serves as Academic Dean for Bright, B-R-I-T-E, the Blue Ridge Institute for Theological Education, which is based out of Roanoke, but is all over West Virginia as well as Eastern Tennessee now. Welcome to the program, Sean. It's so good to see you.
Thanks so much, Camden. Very glad to be here. As they say, long time listener, first time caller. Glad to be on the show.
Right. Well, no need to bring a chicken sandwich or anything of the sort to this this program. Of course, Sean is frequently on the program PresbyCast, our good friends over there. We just had Brad on the program not too long ago. And Sean and I were able to spend some time along with Ryan and Hannah at PCA General Assembly one night, especially a couple nights, but we had a good time and got to speak with both you and one of the Presby girls, your wife, Sarah. That was a wonderful evening. We had a great time. Ryan and I were just remarking about how fun you two are. And he's like, Ryan is like, yeah, they got a really good sense of humor. I was like, yeah, they're fun to hang out with.
We try to, you know, to worship hard, to pray hard, to labor hard in the courts of the church, and then also to laugh hard and feast hard and rejoice in the Lord and have a good time as
Amen.
Much as we can.
Praise God. We really appreciate that. I'm glad that you guys seem to have a good time. Overall, I thought it was a really encouraging and wonderful assembly. In the previous week's episode, but in terms of podcast time, which, you know, we time travel because recording and releasing, we don't release them immediately. We release on Fridays. So yesterday, my time, I got to speak with Jonathan Master, president down in Greenville, about his new book, Reformed Theology. So we were reminiscing a little bit, or just recollecting some of the events from the assembly, and it was great. So what would you say overall, what are your high points, whether serious or not so serious, of the assembly for this year?
Yeah, it was a good year. It was a banner year for us in the PCA, because it was our 50th anniversary. And as folks are well aware, it's also been, particularly in the last 3 months or so, a particularly heavy season in the life of the PCA.
Yeah.
Think back to late March was the tragic school shooting at the Covenant School in Nashville, Tennessee. That's a Christian school that's associated with Covenant Presbyterian Church, PCA, in Nashville. Mm-hmm. And then just within the last month, we had the deaths of three men who were particularly significant in the life of our denomination. Steve Smallman, And then just a few weeks later, Harry Reader went home to be with the Lord. And then just a day later, Tim Keller went home to be with the Lord. And so that's all, you know, and then the GA happens right on the heels of all that.
Right.
And of course, we've had years of the past 3, 4, 5, 6 years or so, some pretty heavy doctrinal discussions and polity discussions and disagreements in the life of our communion that have weighed heavily, I think, on the consciences and of folks. And so this year, all the emotions were swirling internally. And so it was, in many ways, it was cathartic, I think, to worship together, to grieve together, to celebrate God's kindness toward our denomination for half a century now, and to be together. And even in those areas on the where there were sharp disagreements on the floor of the assembly, there really was a fraternal accord there and a collegiality and a cordial spirit, I think, amongst the brothers that was really good to see. And I think that bodes well in God's kindness for years to come.
Mm-hmm. I was amazed how early you finished on Thursday. I think it was in 3:30 or something like that. And I was gearing up for you guys to be out late working Thursday night and thinking that, we'll just have to find something else to do because all the PCA guys will be busy. But
yeah,
with the able assistance and moderation of Fred Greco, you were able to knock that out pretty quickly.
Yeah, that's right. You know, our typical pattern is we begin the assembly proper on Tuesday evening. Now there's committees that have been working during the day prior to that on Tuesday and on Monday, but we typically begin with worship on Tuesday evening, and then we work all day Wednesday, all day Thursday, usually late into the night on Thursday, and occasionally we spill over into Friday morning, breaking by lunchtime. That doesn't happen all the time, but it has been known to happen. But thanks to the procedural wizardry of Fred Greco last year, we were able to conclude business before dinner break on Thursday evening. And so we had all of Thursday evening to fellowship, and folks traveled home Friday. And then this year, with Fred as our actual moderator of the assembly, through his, he did such a fine job. He was so professional. He's so knowledgeable of the BCO and the RAO, Rules of Assembly Operations, and the Roberts rules and the ins and outs of those things. So he ran such a fair and judicious and efficient assembly that, yeah, you're right, Camden. We wrapped up, if I'm not mistaken, at 3:47 p.m. Central Time on Thursday. And so commissioners just had the opportunity. They could go home, or what number of us did, just enjoyed an evening of fellowship and then went on home Friday morning.
Yeah. I believe our assembly, we didn't get done on a Thursday. We got done much earlier. We got done on a Tuesday morning.
Okay.
Problem is we started on a Wednesday night. So that's how long we're working. We work all day, every day, except the Lord's Day. So I was talking to a PCA friend of mine. He said, "Even Saturday?" I was like, "Yes, even Saturday, six days shalt thou work. And the seventh you rest." So yeah, it's a different style of things. We've had plenty of talks about that, both on and off the air, about how the different assemblies work. And of course, we're much smaller to begin with, but even being smaller in terms of absolute numbers, we're smaller in terms of our assembly because we elect people. We have some people would say a delegated assembly, although we like to call our participants and people who vote commissioners.
Okay.
Nevertheless, when the times that I have sat in your overtures committee, if anyone's wondering, that's kind of how the OPC General Assembly feels a lot of times in terms of parliamentary feel and operation. If you get more than 150 or so people doing parliamentary procedure, it's just, you can't do business on the floor in the same way. You just have to do it differently, which is what you guys do. And with a very precise time limits on speeches, business, all that kind of stuff. You just have to do it that way. We like to, you know, let all the work go on the floor and everyone gets to say what they want to say. You get two speeches per item of business. And unless there is a trial or something with specific time limits for debate, you know, it's a free for all, and the work gets done when it gets done. I don't know. Jim, have you ever been to the PCA General Assembly to see it?
I have. I forget the year, Sean, but it was in Pittsburgh, the year that it was up in Pittsburgh, and really enjoyed my time there. You know, one thing that, you know, by way of contrast, I was going to say is that our work, the work of our General Assembly, we use a significant portion of our time dealing with judicial cases. Mm-hmm. So we deal with those judicial cases on the floor as an assembly, mm-hmm. whereas you all have the SJC, right? And all those cases get decided off the floor throughout the course of the year and whatnot, so that the assembly doesn't have to deal with that on the floor of the assembly as a whole. So that's a significant portion of why it is that we meet so much and so many hours is, and part of the reason why, you probably know this already, but part of the reason why we do that is because of the way in which Machen was dealt in his appeal, that kind of went to the PCUSA's version of the SJC, and never had a chance to appeal his matter before the floor of the General Assembly itself. Right. And people saw that as, that wasn't, you know, that wasn't good for us. And so when the OPCGA was formed, we kind of went in that direction.
Yep. It makes sense. You know, different denominations have their different cultures, and, you know, there's always historical and cultural reasons for that. And, you know, I think of you all in the OPC General Assembly. And of course, one of my ruling elders was privileged to be the PCA's fraternal delegate to greet you all. And I know he was so as excited and overjoyed as he ever gets, he was excited and overjoyed to have that opportunity. He was on the 100th year of Machen's Christianity and liberalism. But the point being that as hard as it is to moderate and orchestrate a conversation amongst, what are there roughly 150, 200 of you all on the floor of GA?
Just about, in the ball. Yeah, it's about 150. I don't know the precise number, but it's 150. Okay. I should know. Okay. I used to know.
That's all right. Yeah, 150. And of course, that's roughly the size of our Overtures Committee. And so as hard as it is to orchestrate and navigate a conversation amongst 150, then you on the floor of our assembly, it's 2,100 and even more difficult to try and orchestrate a conversation amongst that many people. So, just different realities of the different corners that we are in the NAEPARC world. Yeah,
certainly. And it's just not possible to do. I mean, it's not practically possible to do a full judicial proceeding with 2,000 people.
Right.
It's just, I get it. Like, I don't necessarily say one is better than the other. They have their advantages, but if we did want to involve that many people in an assembly floor, Jim, I don't think we'd be doing the same things that we do right now. Anyway, you just have to be different.
Nope. But, yep, sure.
Well, we're going to be rewinding the clock a little bit and revisiting some of the beginnings of Presbyterianism per se. Of course, Acts 15 is really the beginning. And as your elder Brad once said, I think it was at the last General Assembly, 2022, Acts 14 plus Acts 15 does not equal Acts 29. That's a t-shirt waiting to happen. But we're going to be speaking today about John Knox and a significant reformer he was, also a Scottish theologian and Presbyterian. So we're very indebted to the beginnings of Presbyterianism, you know, at least in the 16th century, and everything that entails, including church government, certain understandings of ecclesiology, polity, and other matters regarding worship and the sacraments. So, Sean, I'm wondering if you might introduce us a little bit to your interest in John Knox and some of the research that you're conducting and some things that you're hoping to accomplish perhaps in the next couple of years.
Yeah, be glad to talk about John Knox for as long as the good friends at Crisis Center will permit us to do.
Let's do it.
But I attended seminary at Reformed Theological Seminary in Jackson at the mothership, the original campus, and then I took my first call to our PCA church in southwestern Virginia in early 2015. And shortly after that, I started doing the THM program through Edinburgh Theological Seminary, which is a joint venture between ETS and the University of Glasgow. And through my studies in seminary and the mentoring that I got at First Presbyterian Church in Jackson, my interests were really attuned to Scottish church history, Scottish Presbyterianism. And so for my THM research, I was more, see, I have a musical background from my undergraduate days. And so just, you know, the fascination that I've had in American Presbyterianism and Scottish Presbyterianism with our histories of psalmody and hymnody and so forth. So I did my THM research on psalmody in the Church of Scotland. And so when I finished the THM and I knew I wanted to go on to do further studies at the PhD level, I knew I wanted to keep it in the realm of Scottish Presbyterianism. But I wanted to get more on an historical figure. Now, my familiarity with Free Church of Scotland, you know, I had been fairly familiar with names like Andrew Bonner and Robert Murray McShane and things of that nature. And initially, I had wanted to do some PhD research on McShane. I've worshipped at that congregation, St. Peter's Free Church in Dundee, several times. I have touched and stood in McShane's pulpit. You know, in the Reformed world, we don't have relics, but if there were anything like Reformed relics, McShane's pulpit might be one of them. So I love McShane, but a number of the academic advisors in my life suggested that because McShane died so early at age 29, he did not leave behind a vast corpus of literature by which one might be able to do a doctoral level project on him. Now, our friend Dr. Jordan Stone, who's a pastor at Redeemer McKinney, Texas, PCA congregation, he did do his PhD on McShane, so he might dispute that notion. But maybe he did the one PhD that can be done, and now it's been exhausted. But that's fine. So
PhD topics can never be exhausted, Sean. they're not only inexhaustible, but oftentimes incomprehensible.
Incomprehensible. That's right. So, well, be that as it may, the powers that be in PhD application world were saying, Sean, there's probably not much to do with McShane. Why don't you consider another major figure of Scottish Presbyterianism? And with the 2015 release of that major biography on John Knox that was written by Professor Jane Dawson, which is a wonderful work, which has really opened up a whole new field of opportunity regarding Knoxian studies for us. They said, you know, doing some more research on John Knox might be the way to go. And so I did some digging, and for my initial research, had only found maybe half a dozen or so PhD dissertations on John Knox, the so-called father of Presbyterianism. There's lots of different biographies. There's lots of different both scholarly and popular level biographies on Knox. But in terms of specific PhD dissertations, I've only been able to locate six or seven. And so they've looked at Knox from a variety of angles, the ones that you might expect. Knox as the bold and courageous preacher, Knox the reformer, Knox the statesman, even Knox the educational reformer. There was even one dissertation that I found where the lady was basically looking at him as, you know, Knox the horrendous misogynist. Let's look at him, you know, through that particular lens. Mm-hmm. But as best as I could find, no one had yet analyzed Knox the pastor, Knox and his pastoral emphases. So that's the angle that I've decided to try and take. And of course, I'm not saying no one here would argue that preaching is not part of pastoring. Of course it is. But looking, you know, there has been some analysis of Knox and his preaching, although we don't have a ton of Knox's sermons the way we do Calvin. You know, Knox did not have a stenographer taking down copious notes of his preaching the way Knox had in his congregation. So we only have two or three sermons of Knox's in that. But we do have so many of his letters, so many of his correspondences. Thanks to the work of Jane Dawson, we even have more letters that she unearthed that are able to serve us in Knoxian research. And of course, we have Knox's autobiography, The Reformation of the Church in Scotland, where we get a look into the man's thought and into his mind as God in his providence was carrying out Reformation in his homeland. And we could see what his pastoral concerns were and what his labors were. And so that's what I've attempted. That's what I'm going to attempt to do, Lord willing, as I get further along in this PhD research. I'm studying at Puritan Reformed Theological Seminary under the supervision of Dr. Stephen Myers. He's a systematic theologian, historical theologian, ordained ARP minister, wonderful brother. And so he's been immensely helpful as I've been getting going on this project. And so we're essentially structuring this project just looking at Knox in the various different pulpits or parishes in which he served, both in Scotland and abroad, and trying to see, to discern what were his major pastoral concerns for his people. Mm-hmm. What were the pressing pastoral issues and needs of his people in those situations, in those contexts? What were the major things he was hitting home on beyond just his preaching ministry? What were his shepherding concerns? And so this project, hopefully, in the end, will be something of a toward a pastoral theology of John Knox.
That's tremendous. Can you imagine if there's, let's just say, a PCA minister wrote a book? What would happen to this man on Twitter if he wrote and titled a book called The First Blast of the Trumpet Against the Monstrous Regiment of Women? You imagine the evisceration you would experience?
You get canceled right away.
Yeah, no doubt. You know, people like to speculate, you know, if, of all the reformers, you know, who would be the most outlandish or outrageous on Twitter today? And there seems to be a consensus that it probably would have been Luther.
Yeah.
Calvin would have been too careful and precise to ever say anything overly outrageous, though he may have had his moments, but he would have been too careful and precise to get the sort of Twitter-worthy hot takes and controversies that come out of that. But, you know, Knox, with a title like that, you know, he may have been close behind in terms of getting eviscerated by the Twitter mobs, as
sure.
They were.
I've got this is a little bit off topic, but I think it'll open up some areas of exploration in our conversation. So I'm asking ever so slightly tongue in cheek, but it's an interesting counterfactual or hypothetical question.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So you've dealt with the psalmody in worship. Mm-hmm. Some of the issue here, especially as we're going to be speaking about Scottish Presbyterianism, might overlap with issues such as the regulative principle of worship. We'll talk about that, I suspect, a little bit later. Mm-hmm. But many of our brothers of this tradition are exclusive psalmists. What happens? Here's the tongue-in-cheek part. So don't write in, everyone, saying Camden's got these weird ideas about exclusive psalmody or he doesn't understand it. It's slightly tongue-in-cheek so that we can think about this maybe from another perspective. What would happen, do you think, to some exclusive psalmists if, for example, archaeologists uncovered an original manuscript of the tunes that David used? I don't know how this would be possible, but let's say we could verify that this indeed is musical notation
mm-hmm.
of these psalms that were used in the Lord's worship at the time. Would we not only start to see exclusive psalmists regarding the words, but saying now these are the only tunes that may be used in worship?
We may very well. It is interesting because in some of the psalms, right, you have those superscriptions and
exactly.
It'll say this psalm to the tune, the Doe of the Dawn,
right.
or something of that nature. And so that's been, you know, for some, and I wouldn't include myself in that, but for some that has been a hang up against exclusive psalmody because they will say, well, you could sing the words, but apparently you're supposed to sing it to this tune as well, and you don't have that. So how can you rightly practice it? You know, you have some folks saying that, but I think for most folks, it's at least a curiosity of we have the words preserved, praise the Lord, because of the doctrine of God's preservation of his word. But we have lost these ancient tunes to which
yeah.
they were sung originally. And yeah, what might those have sounded like? What might those have been? And we may never know. Maybe we'll find out in glory. Maybe we won't.
Right. I love our Trinity Psalter hymnal we're using in our church, the new one published in 2018, joint project between the OPC and the URCNA. And I know many PCA congregations are using that as well. But even there, as new as that is in 2018, and I'm not criticizing my brothers who are at work on this, but there's a few tunes in there I wish were not preserved.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep, that's right. It's interesting, and it's we're getting tangential, and that's fine. But it is interesting that in my research on the development from psalmody into hymnody in the Church of Scotland, there were both theological reasons as well as practical reasons that gave way to that. And one of the more practical reasons, particularly in these more rural Scottish congregations, is we have these letters of some of the parishioners who were just fed up. They were fed up of singing the same five tunes over and over again. They were saying, we've got 150 psalms and you people never use more than five tunes. And so it's just singing the same thing over and over.
Sure.
Would it kill you to give us a little bit of variety? And so that in some cases, that dissatisfaction paved the way to folks being more open to hymnody later on. So mm-hmm. for whatever that's worth, that's just an interesting historical anecdote.
Sure. Tell us a bit about John Knox's church context, maybe a sketch, not in great detail unless you want to, but in mm-hmm. terms of his biography. But what were his experiences as a pastor, as we're going to be moving toward at least sketching out something of a pastoral theology for Knox? Tell us about his context. What were the people like that he was serving? What were the particular contexts in which he served? Whatever might inform our understanding of the formation of his thoughts on this matter.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I'll give a little bit of biography, but not go overly in depth. We think we don't have a precise date. Our best guess is that Knox was born roughly around 1514 on the outskirts of Haddington, southern plains of Scotland. And he grew up, if we want to be anachronistic, but Roman Catholic, the Roman Catholic Church, the medieval church was still the dominant power, of course, in Scotland in those days. 1532 or so, Knox was sent to study at the University of St. Andrews. And just by way of reference, 1536, so 4 years later, this is when Calvin published the Institutes of the Christian Religion. So that first edition. And in 1540, so 4 years after that first edition of Calvin's Institutes is released, Knox is ordained to the Roman Catholic priesthood. He served as a kind of what's called papal notary. And so it was this interesting mixture of both priest, but also something of a local legal scholar, and something almost like a notary public would be today. And so Knox was an academic, at least, and that's how he intended to be, at least in some regard. I don't know that he ever fancied himself growing up to be a university professor. It's interesting. It's an irony worth highlighting. One of the things that Dawson notes in her work is how much Knox was a man who loved the spoken word. He was a man who loved rhetoric. He loved the preached word. He was not so much inclined to the written word or the things that, you know, one would associate with a scholar's pursuit. And to be honest with you, that's part of the reason why I was drawn to him. And that's the irony there, is that, you know, I'm a preacher, I'm a minister, I love the preaching of the word, I love the preached word. I'm not always inclined to lengthy written works, at least temperamentally and with my own skill set. And so it's no small amount of irony that I'm going to be spending a ton of written work and written words by a man who's not so much inclined to written words, about a man who wasn't so inclined to written words, but preferred the verbal word or the spoken word. So, but at least in his early years, he assumed that he would just maybe go on to study at the university, maybe to be a Latin tutor. And that's what he was doing for a number of years, was tutoring Scottish lord's sons in Latin. But he got caught up in the ministry of George Wishart in the mid-1540s. Wishart, Scottish evangelist, had gone to Europe and become familiarized with the teachings of Martin Luther, came back, and was one of those proto-reformers going around preaching the gospel in Scotland, much to the chagrin of the Roman Catholic authorities and hierarchy there in Scotland. But Knox was converted reading John 17. That's a thing that comes back over and over again in his autobiographical reflections. John 17, he famously says that is where he cast his first anchor, where I cast my first anchor, John 17 and Christ's high priestly prayer. And so just reading his Bible, and in John 17, we think that that's when Knox was essentially converted. And then about a year later, he comes into contact with George Wishart, and he's captivated by this man's ministry. He wants to be helping him out and going with him, and he serves as his bodyguard. he serves as his Secret Service agent, body man, carrying one of those two-handed broadswords, Scottish broadswords, often at the front of the parade when Wishart was traveling from town to town. And they got into hot water there in St. Andrews. Cardinal David Beaton was the cardinal there in St. Andrews. George Wishart was burned alive. And you can still go to St. Andrews to this day and find the marble stone, or the stones in the pavement, where there's a GW on the spot where Wishart was burned at the stake. And, of course, the the fledgling Protestant group that was there in revenge murdered Cardinal Beaton, and they ended up taking refuge in St. Andrew's Castle and went into hiding there. And it is in those moments that this fledgling Protestant congregation realized that the young Knox, they wanted him to be their next pastor to take on the mantle of Wishart. And Knox really struggled with that. He wrestled with that sense of calling. He was unsure. When the congregation first expressed their external call to him, he was so overwhelmed that he ran out of the room. He could not handle it, but eventually he came to himself and came to his senses and perhaps even reluctantly accepted that call to be the pastor of this fledgling refugee congregation of sorts there in St. Andrews. And so from there, his ministry really took off, and that's where we see him ministering in a variety of different contexts, as a galley slave there, right, on the French ship, as a military chaplain, technically under the auspices of the Church of England, mm-hmm, as a chaplain royal to young King Edward there in England. Later on in Geneva, he was mentored wonderfully by Calvin for a number of years. Calvin sent him off to Frankfurt to pastor a refugee church of English Protestants there in Frankfurt, Germany. We can talk about that in a little bit, but that was a 6 or 7 month commitment that didn't go so well. But he pastored there, went back to Geneva, pastored another refugee church, did some itinerant preaching in Scotland for a few months in between calls, and then eventually wound his way back to his homeland. He always felt that call that he needed to get back to his homeland of Scotland to labor for the cause of Reformation there. He'd been ministering to the, if you will, proto-Protestants in his homeland for a number of years via letter and with a few short personal visits. But once Bloody Mary died in England in 1558, finally it was safe for him to make way passage back to Scotland via England. And so in 1559, he makes his way away from Geneva back to England, traveling through to get back to Scotland. And there he labored for the cause of the Scottish Reformation till the end of his days.
I think it was Knox. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think it was Knox who said of Calvin's Geneva that it was the most perfect school or something like that. Can you tell us a little bit about Knox's evaluation of Calvin, his ministry, and the way that he saw the church form there in Geneva?
That's right. That's a very famous expression that Knox used to describe what he observed at St. Pierre's and in Calvin's ministry in Geneva. The most perfect school of Christ since the apostles was how he esteemed it. And, you know, maybe he was given over to a little bit of exaggeration there, but nevertheless, he was captivated by what he saw, particularly in the realm of worship and Calvin's early efforts toward reforming certainly worship services and the Lord's Supper and shepherding and even issues of church discipline. And so while he made his own modifications, Knox essentially took what he saw in Geneva and what he observed under Calvin's ministry, and he wanted to export that back to Scotland when he was given the opportunity. That's why, you know, it's interesting because Calvin doesn't get the ascription, the father of Presbyterianism. Knox gets the ascription, the so-called father of Presbyterianism. But so much of what Knox learned, he learned from the hand of Calvin, his mentor, if we want to be slightly anachronistic, to use a term that may not have been used then. And I think that's because what Knox was able to implement in one city-state, such as Geneva was in those days, Knox was able to implement on a national scale for an entire country. So not just the city of Edinburgh, not just the city of Glasgow, but all throughout the Scottish nation. He was able to bring about the establishment of a new Protestant and Reformed Church of Scotland and that was endorsed and ratified by the nobles, by the nobility and the Scottish hierarchy and landed gentry and so forth. And even though Knox wasn't entirely satisfied with the what is called the First Book of Discipline, and it wouldn't be until later when his successor, Andrew Melville, was able to shepherd him through the Scottish Second Book of Discipline, the things that Knox viewed as compromise and disappointment and things that really caused him to lose sleep at night, I think probably the rest of us, especially when we think of things we wish would happen in the life of our denomination, you know, where we get our way versus when we don't get our way, if we were in Knox's shoes, we probably would have viewed it as a rousing success. But nevertheless, he was given to no small amount of disappointment. For example, that the position of superintendents was included in the Scottish First Book of Discipline. He was not a fan of the existence of superintendents. He wanted ministers, elders, and deacons. And this role of superintendents very greatly frustrated him, that it was this quasi sort of bishop role that got implemented into the First Book of Discipline. And then later it did fade away. And if folks out there, listeners who know their Scottish church history, they'll know that there was some tension there between the first and second books, and the role of the superintendent did evolve into a sort of quasi office of bishop in some regards, but eventually it was done away with. But again, the Scots Confession and the Book of Discipline that he and the five other Johns were able to draft up in a matter of a few days' time, the fact that thing was wholeheartedly adopted by the Council of Estates, the landed gentry, with only that slight modification regarding the office, the position of superintendent, and they still accepted everything wholesale that Knox proposed. So, I mean, 99 out of 100 ain't bad when you're reforming a church from scratch. And then, so that's a pretty good victory when you're setting forth in the uncharted territory and charting out the Scottish Reformation such as it was.
It is impressive. Let's talk a bit about his ministry among the Frankfurters. This might also help us to understand better the role or the development of the regulative principle of worship, which is near and dear to our hearts. And I like to think of it, and when I teach it to our people at church, we usually describe it as the application of sola scriptura to worship, and that we're seeking not to bind anyone's conscience with anything that God does not command. One example I use is I was visiting a church once during the Christmas season, and they had a manger up front, and thankfully, there was no figure of Jesus in the manger. Nevertheless, during the offertory, they encouraged everyone to stand up and walk in front of the manger. And if they so felt so led, they would put their offering in the manger. So I was bound because I thought, well, what in the world is this? Do I participate? Like it put me in a bind because I didn't feel like this was a right circumstance or element of worship, but they called everyone to do it and everyone was doing it. So either I felt like I wasn't participating in worship or I was doing something that I didn't feel was necessarily the right thing to do. So that's one little example of perhaps a violation of the regulative principle. And that church doesn't purport to hold to the regulative principle, so no big deal. It's outside of Nay Park quite a ways. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, it's a useful thing, but we might not understand its origins or certainly how it came into Presbyterianism. What were not some of Knox's thoughts on this? How did this doctrine develop, and what might we learn from his experience in Frankfurt that might shed light on this?
Yeah, no, I appreciate the question. Yeah, and we can talk about this a little bit later, but if Knox's reaction to certain practices surrounding the Lord's Supper are any indication, if he were with you, Camden, when you witnessed what you witnessed, he may have had a cow, to put it in modern parlance, if having witnessed that.
Doing a macho man elbow smash onto that manger.
That's right. That's right. Fair. Yeah. Considering his reaction to some practices around the Lord's Supper, he would have been none too happy about dropping in your offering to the empty manger. He would not have been a fan, to say the least. But yeah, Knox rather was encouraged by Calvin to go and serve a congregation of English refugees in Frankfurt, Germany, for a time. So this was during the high days of persecution. Queen Mary, Bloody Mary, is on the throne. Elizabeth I is not yet on the throne of England. And so lots of Protestants are fleeing England to the continent and finding places to settle where they can in safety. And so the city magistrates of Frankfurt, Germany, have opened the gates to English refugees and made accommodations for them. And these folks need a pastor. And prior to Mary's ascent to the throne, Knox had been serving in England. So not to get back into the weeds of his biography, but eventually when he's released from the galley slave ship, he essentially goes into Church of England ministry after that for a while, both serving as a military chaplain as well as in a couple parish context. And so he had been a Church of England minister for a time. And for, I think, the rest of his life, Knox had this kind of love-hate relationship with the Church of England's Book of Common Prayer, because he actually had a hand in a little bit of it.
Sure.
Sometimes folks don't know this, but at least in the first edition of the Book of Common Prayer, Knox assisted Thomas Cranmer, Bishop Cranmer, in this project. So he, in some cases, was able to minister in Church of England context and parishes according to his conscience, and in other cases he was pressured to perhaps adopt some of the more liturgical elements that were holdovers from the medieval church that he did not care for, and he was pressured to implement those against his conscience, and so he would have to leave. Well, after Mary began her persecution of the Protestants, after Edward VI died in the 1550s, Knox, like so many other Protestants, fled England, went to Geneva, was there for a time, observing Calvin, being mentored by Calvin. And so Calvin eventually pointed out, hey, there's all these English Protestants over in Frankfurt that need a pastor. Why don't you go and be their pastor? And so he did. And it was a short stint, because in many ways, we have what might be the first, or at least one of the few Reformation era examples of what we might call the worship wars. We had an example of the worship wars playing out there in Frankfurt, Germany. So you have all these English Protestants, and in some ways, I think we could be understanding and sympathetic of this, that they're away from home, they're exiles. They want something that just feels familiar. They want something. They want some comfort and solace that comes from that which is familiar. And so they're familiar with the liturgical elements in their Church of England services. And there's a party within that refugee church that wants to hold worship services that are as closely tied to the Book of Common Worship as possible. And so you have this development of what essentially two parties within this congregation: the England party, the Book of Common Prayer party, or the Prayer Book party, as it was called, and the Geneva party. Well, as you might expect, Knox was the representative of the Geneva party, and there was another leader within the church by the man by the name of Richard Cox, and he was the leader of the Prayer Book party. And so there's this little, Knox versus Cox, the worship war playing out within the life of this little congregation. John Knox wanted to keep it as closely to the Geneva liturgy as possible. Cox wanted to keep it as close to the Book of Common Prayer liturgy as possible. And for your listeners that are familiar with John Calvin's Geneva liturgy, they'll notice that when they look at John Knox's form of prayers later on, which is essentially Knox's worship liturgy, they're almost identical. So very simple, very regulative principle, ordinary, plain kind of structure to the worship service. That's what Knox wanted. That's what he had known in Geneva. Cox didn't want that. And so these guys butt heads. And at one point, there's this exchange where Richard Cox famously gives the line that this church, this congregation, being full of English refugees, needs to have the face of England. And Knox retorts, "No, sir, it needs to have the face of Christ." Yeah. And so you see something of the showdown there. I was thinking about that even just driving over here this morning and thinking about our podcast interview and where the conversation might take us. But, on the one hand, we can appreciate and I think sympathize with this desire for commonality and familiarity. I mean, in the PCA, we have a number of distinctly Korean congregations and even whole Korean presbyteries. And these are brothers and sisters who are, in many cases, first and second generation immigrants. Sure. They're far from home. They're here in America, and they want to speak a common language and have fellowship and fraternity one with another, and feel something of at home and a welcome amongst each other. And I think we can understand that. And I think there was something, it's not entirely analogous, but there was something similar to that happening amongst these English Protestants. They just wanted the safety that comes with the familiar of what they were used to back in England. But nevertheless, John Knox and those of the Geneva Party, including his good friend Christopher Goodman, were saying, listen, folks, we appreciate that, but at the end of the day, we have to be faithful to what Christ has commanded in the scripture, not merely that which is most comfortable to you and most familiar to you. And so, well, as your listeners might have guessed, Knox only served there for about 6 or 7 months, and he made his way back to Geneva. So he did not win the day or win the sentiments of that congregation when it came to this this first worship war, as it were.
Sure, sure. It's interesting to think about similar dynamics. I appreciate the way you present that in terms of the worship wars. But instead of desiring, obviously the liturgical forms and those sorts of things were cultural. They had become cultural. They're part of their culture. But, you know, when we think about contemporary worship wars, we're trying to bring in things from pop culture into the church, whereas they were trying to deal with something from their national identity in terms of a national church. It's an interesting dynamic, an interesting interplay. I don't know if there's a direct one-to-one correspondence in the modern day, but I appreciate the connection also to the Korean Presbyterian Church or the Korean PCA congregations. It's a challenge, and mm-hmm. and it's important. And there are many varieties and many ways that we can worship the Lord faithfully according to Scripture, but we always need to be doing that, seeking to worship according to Scripture rather than importing our own ideas into that. Did you find in your research, or have you encountered any similar challenges regarding the sacraments, particularly the Lord's Supper? Were there different notions of how it ought to be celebrated in addition to maybe what was actually happening?
Yeah, and that's, you know, I still have lots of digging and lots of research to do over the next few years, but at least in these early stages, that's the thing that I've come across again and again in Knox's writing, of how concerned he was over the sacrament of the Lord's Supper. He, thus far, at least in my early scannings, he spills more ink over the doctrine of the Lord's Supper than most other items. You know, it's interesting because Knox doesn't fancy himself a scholar. He fancies himself more as a sort of prophet preacher, if anything. But the three, if you will, more scholarly works for which he's known outside of his huge multi-volume Reformation of the Church of Scotland, which serves as something of an autobiography. You know, he has this masterful essay on the doctrine of predestination, and then he has two shorter treatises about the Lord's Supper. One of them is called The Vindication of the Doctrine that the Mass is Idolatry, right? So pushing back against
tell us what you really think.
That's right. Tell us, Knox. If only we could get into the, you know, the first paragraph without knowing what you think about the matter. That's right. So he has this. That's the longer work, The Vindication of the Doctrine that the Mass is Idolatry. And then following up on that, he has a much shorter treatise on simply the doctrine of the Lord's Supper. So one is more of a refutation of the medieval doctrine and superstitions that we're carrying over. And then the latter one is more of a user's manual, if you like, of how your average Protestant should go about officiating and conducting the Lord's Supper and what was happening there. Knox, if nothing else, was a man of principle, and there were certain principles that he had that just could not be compromised. You know, that was the thing that he had perhaps the most hang-up about that led to his eventual resignation, his departure from the Church at Frankfurt, is he just could not get over the English manner of observing the Lord's Supper that was being insisted upon. And there were multiple instances of Knox, both at the Frankfurt Church and in other contexts, where some folks would just say, Knox, can you just preach? Just come and preach and pray for us and lead us and just let one of these other guys, because there were multiple pastors on staff, if you like, and they would say, just have one of these other ministers officiate the Lord's Supper if you can't bring yourself to do it because you have such strenuous objections against it. Just let them do it. You handle the preaching. Let them do the Lord's Supper, and you know, won't that be enough? And he just said, no, I can't be a party to this. He viewed that there were enough leftover, holdover medieval practices in the Church of England manner of observing the supper that it was just too idolatrous, and he could not abide with that. And one of them, frankly, was the posture or the practice of kneeling. Now, that might surprise a lot of our listeners, but Knox could not stand kneeling at the Lord's Supper. And so it's interesting. I mean, context is everything in so many of these cases. All three of us probably could think of NAEPARC churches, good NAEPARC churches, where it might be the practice in that church from time to time that the congregants are invited to kneel during prayer or something like that. And for Knox, that would have been absolutely outrageous. You don't kneel, because that is Romish, that is papist, that is, that kind of genuflection is indicating that you're worshiping the host, the transubstantiated bread and wine, the flesh and blood of Christ, and you just do not do that. You do not kneel. Mm-hmm. It had such an idolatrous connotation for him. And for us, perhaps it doesn't have that kind of idolatrous connotation as a prayer posture, at least in some congregations, but we're 500 years later. But Knox, as he is there in the thick of the context, kneeling at the Lord's Supper was something he could not abide with. He wanted to, you know, I think his preference may have been to distribute the elements, to go where the people were seated or where they were standing, and for the elder or the minister to bring the elements to the people. But he was at least willing to say, well, let them come forward and I'll hand them the elements. But the prayer book party at Frankfurt and others, they wanted to insist that the congregants kneel at the railing at the front of the room for the Lord's Supper. And Knox simply, he could not get his conscience would not be assuaged on that matter. He could not abide with that.
This has been an incredible discussion, especially the worship wars going on in Frankfurt. That was an awesome account of that story. So many lessons to be learned here. I'd like to take us in a slightly different direction, away from the Lord's table, although, boy, I know there's a lot there with the Lord's Supper. You may recall an issue of the Confessional Presbyterian Journal not many years ago with the picture of Knox on the cover administering the Lord's Supper. Such a cool thing there, and that's a great issue if people want to read more on Knox. But my question has to do with the pastoral practice of the local church. Mm-hmm. And I don't know quite how to put the question in a way that isn't anachronistic. Sorry, anachronistic.
Here's the New Jersey coming.
that was just a brain cramp is what that was. But in terms of a session, the work of the elders, what was the pastoral work like on the local level? Was it all the pastor? Was it all Knox? Or were ruling elders involved? Were there multiple pastors? What did it look like?
Yeah. Well, let me attempt to give something of an answer there by looking at two stages. So you got stage one of Knox's ministry in Scotland, and then his later, more established long-term ministry at stage two. And his first stage one ministry, he was frankly something more of an itinerant preacher. This was when he was between calls. Geneva was still his home base, but he went home to Scotland for about a year or so, frankly, just to be something of an unofficial pastor as best he could to the Protestants there. So he traveled from town to town, visiting the people, encouraging them. There was still no official Protestant church structure established or in place during those days. But he counseled them, and he said, basically, if issues arise in your doctrine or your understanding, please write me a letter, or write, you know, Christopher Goodman a letter, or some of these other pastoral colleagues. We'll be back in Geneva, but send us a letter. We'll do our best to settle this issue for you and just keep holding firm until our return. There's something Pauline, Apostle Pauline, about that in some regards during these fledgling days of the Scottish Church. But part of what Knox did there was just go to these, he called them the privy kirks. They might look something like a house church to us these days, just families or groups of families gathering to read the Bible, to pray together, for Christian fellowship, to do the best they could in the absence of a regular ordained ministry there. And he structured those as best he could, gave them counsel, and said, just keep doing this until we're able to return, until the Lord in his providence paves the way for us to have a more structured and established Protestant presence in the kingdom of Scotland. And that right there, and I've made this case to others both formally and informally, speaks, I think, to the remarkable portability to the Reformed faith, that Knox, even in the absence of a regular ministry, was able to have the essentials of Christian worship and the essentials of Christian fellowship in place that these folks could implement in his absence. Prayer and reading the scripture, and folks essentially like almost in a kind of small group format, sharing things that stand out to them from the scripture as they're seeking to edify one another. Now, obviously, they couldn't have sacraments in his absence, and there wouldn't be the formal preaching of the word, if you like, but it was something for them to get by on in a rudimentary reformed practice until he was able to come back. Well, once Elizabeth the First comes to the throne, Protestant Elizabeth, and he wasn't able to go through England. I may have misspoken earlier, because poor Docs, he just had the most unfortunate timing, because it was right around then that his treatise, you know, the first blast of the trumpet against the monstrous regiment of women, came out, and then Elizabeth was crowned, you know, virtually the next day. He wasn't even intending to direct that toward her. He was intending to direct that more toward her predecessor, right, Bloody Mary. But poor Knox, ill-timed thing. Elizabeth reads it. She gets terribly offended. And when he wants to come back through England to get to Scotland, she says no. So he has to go the long way around. But still, he's able to get safe passage to Scotland, and there he labored for a while in St. Andrews, and then eventually the St. Giles Kirk in Edinburgh called him to be their pastor, and he went to work. And of course, many of your listeners will know the story of the so-called Six Johns, as they scrambled to put together the Scots Confession of 1560 in just a matter of days. Wow. And that first Book of Discipline, and once that was approved by the General Estates, the nobility of the Scottish kingdom, they went to work, and they basically, in a manner almost a little bit parallel to the later work of the Westminster Assembly, where in the midst of their deliberations, they were examining ministers for ordination and going through ordination trials. Mm-hmm. Knox and those men were doing something like that as well. Different men were put forth from different congregations in Edinburgh and Perth and elsewhere. And, so this man is approved. We're going to examine him. He's approved to be a minister. This man is approved to be a reader. So a reader could preach sermons, whereas a minister could do preaching and sacraments. This man is approved to be an elder. These men are examined. And so they got to work quickly in establishing Presbyterian structure in these Scottish churches as quickly as they could from the earliest of days. And I had mentioned the superintendents earlier. So that came about, frankly, as a compromise of necessity, because you had a couple of churches where no man came forth either at all, because there wasn't a man, or the men that were sent to represent those congregations weren't quite qualified. They didn't quite pass muster, mm-hmm, when they were examined. So they didn't have an elder or a pastor present there. So these superintendents, as they were called, were something like a traveling preacher who could fill in and do long-term pulpit supply in the meantime, until that local church had a man who was able to serve rootedly in that local context. Knox actually feared, because he knew that he was the leader of the band, he feared that he was going to get drafted into being one of those superintendents, and he sure didn't want to be. Mm. But mercifully, he was left alone, and he was able to continue on in his call as the pastor at St. Giles Kirk there in Edinburgh, and from the capital city, from the High Kirk there in the heart of the Scottish capital, he was able to exercise great influence on the Scottish Reformation in its earliest of days.
Wow. It sounds a little bit like the work of what we have in the OPC called the regional home missionary. That's interesting.
Okay.
You know, not the exact same thing, obviously, but some of the function there overlaps. Maybe I'll start calling our RHM our superintendent, see if he likes
superintendents.
It. See if he likes that.
That's right.
Anyway,
that's right.
This has been a really tremendous conversation. Our buddy Jim had to jet real quick. He had a hard out. He thanks you for the wonderful questions. And I was certainly appreciative of all the conversation. This is definitely something that I would love to follow up on, and certainly like to hear more as your research develops, and certainly would like to follow up with matters to see how things are going. But I might ask you, are there any recommended reading in addition to what you've already mentioned early on, or what about our listeners who might want to follow up with some of these ideas? Is there anything you suggest or anything that you find interesting or provocative?
Yeah, well, you can't go wrong by starting with the recent biography from Jane Dawson. I think it was released about 2015 from Yale University Press. So I guess it's pushing 8 years old now. But Jane Dawson, her biography on John Knox, and it's pretty thick and it's pretty tiny print. So it's a good lengthy read. I think I have a copy here. Yeah, I'm looking at 373 pages of looks to be maybe 9 font size print. Now that's inclusive of all the end notes, but still, nevertheless, yeah, sure. That'll keep you occupied for a good while. But there's plenty of other biographies. Right. Some are written at a more popular level. That'll get you started. There's a great little documentary movie, a one video movie on John Knox that was released just a few years ago. And actually, Jane Dawson is featured prominently in that documentary. And so folks are more visually inclined. It used to be free for Amazon Prime subscribers. I don't know if it still is, but I think it's just called Knox, and there might be some sort of subtitle. I watched it a couple of years ago, and it's not overly long. It's maybe 45 minutes to an hour, but that's a great little movie that you can sit down in an evening and get a good overview on who this man was. And and they present, one of the things I appreciate about Dawson is that she presents a neither hagiography nor overly critical presentation of Knox. I don't know where she stands ultimately at the end of the day in her personal opinion of the man, but I think she's eminently fair. She neither presents him as, you know, some sort of next generation saint who could do no wrong, but neither does she present him as this woeful, misogynistic woman hater. She presents him in all of his complexity, and I appreciate that about her, in that his mouth got him into trouble sometimes, but at the same time, he was so beloved. He loved his dear wife. He had beloved female members of his congregation that he carried on tender relationships with, pastoral relations and written correspondence. He loved his mother-in-law. How many men can say that? I don't know, but John Knox could, and she loved him back. And so I appreciate that portrayal the Dawson gives of Knox. You know, it just struck me, the first volume that was written by the recently departed to go home and be with the Lord, Donald MacLeod, his first volume, and I think what he intended to be a trilogy of Scottish theology, but thankfully he was able to complete that first volume, which covers Knox and some of that early Scottish church history. That's a good introductory overview that your listeners might enjoy if they want to dip their toes into who Knox was and what that ministry was about. Therefore, the Truth I Speak. That's the name. That's the title of the book. So, Therefore, the Truth I Speak, Volume 1 by MacLeod. That'll give a great introduction. And then, you know, on they might go. If they really want to get into the nitty-gritty, it's worth picking up a copy of the first and second books of Discipline. And if for the real sort of BCO wonks and nerds amongst us, they'll appreciate that. And you can see how, I mean, one of the key things I need to emphasize is that Knox was called the father of Scottish Presbyterianism, but in many ways he was pioneering that Presbyterian effort. He didn't get everything settled the way he had hoped, but he thankfully, through his labors, which the Lord blessed, he was able to pave the way for his later successors like Andrew Melville, like Robert Bruce later at St. Giles Kirk. They were able to enjoy the fruits of his labors of a more settled and established Presbyterianism thanks to Knox's pioneering work. And so that's worth noting as well. But you know, anybody, you can scan, browse through Google and find any fine works of a variety of biographies on John Knox. And if you can find a copy, they're somewhat hard to come by and they're grossly expensive these days. But the Dictionary of Scottish Church History and Theology, they might be out of print. And so that's why they're hard to come by. But that'll give you, looking at Knox, looking at Melville, looking at Wishart, looking at Patrick Hamilton and some of the influences on Knox, they'll point you in the right direction just to give you those bite-sized biographies that'll introduce you to these men. And of course, that dictionary is chock full of all kinds of references and a great bibliography to give you further reading to delve deeper into the world of Knox. And then if they really want to go whole hog, get the 6-volume works of John Knox that you can find from Banner of Truth if you want the hardbound copy.
Nice.
Or you can acquire it, a digital version on Logos. I tend to use both as I'm digging through the primary sources of Knox. So both will be of benefit if a person wants to get more familiar with the man and see what makes him tick.
Yeah, That's useful. I appreciate that. It's nice to think of Knox as a pioneer. I think that's a very Presbyterian way to put it as well, that this work does not rest or depend upon one person alone. But even as we have a plurality of elders and even a plurality of churches and presbyteries in our more fully developed Presbyterian polity, we see people building upon the work of Knox. He's not Bishop Knox, Superintendent Knox, but one presbyter among others. And that's wonderful. Leads to a stronger, perhaps wiser, but more biblical presentation. So that's great.
That's right.
I got one more question for you, Sean.
Yes, sir.
It's not about Knox. So I did have this very providential encounter on the streets of Memphis, where I was walking along, minding my own business, coming. I think I just parked the car in the deck. And lo and behold, the power couple came riding up to me on scooters. So Seth and Zoe Miller, hashtag power couple, I've come to learn. I caught them. I guess you could call me Presby Girl Paparazzi. But I did not catch you and your wife riding any said vehicles. Was there any instance of any paparazzi moments with you and your lovely wife, Sarah, at GA?
The Presby Girls paparazzi. You know that's going to stick now that you've put that out there. That's wonderful. No, the Morrises did not take up any of those scooter rentals. I think the Morrises may have tripped over a few of those scooters as they were
all over the place,
carelessly left on the sidewalks of the streets of Memphis. But no, we, you know, one of the things at PCAGA is that we eat too well. There's lots of good food. And in Memphis, there's lots of good barbecue, lots of good ribs. And so we opted to do a lot of walking in order to make up for the too much of the good food that we ate. And Mrs. Morris, Miss Sarah, we are expecting our fourth child on the way here in a couple of months. And so if we didn't walk,
scooters might make that tough.
We got an Uber, or we took the free shuttle, and the missus was quite grateful for that to go from place to place.
Well, I was thinking maybe next time, well, it's too late now, but I don't know if you saw those LED horse carriages. That might have worked.
You know, I made that suggestion to her, and she surprisingly turned it down. I made that suggestion to Brad Isbell, and I didn't get any response out of that. I made that suggestion to Nick Bullock, and if I would have pressed him on it, he would have taken me up on the offer, so which would have been frightening in all kinds of regards.
It's a spectacle in more ways than one, but it was That's a fun right. assembly. We had a wonderful time. I enjoyed it as an observer, as an exhibitor in the conference, you know, exhibition room, all that sort of stuff. It was fun. It's good to see brothers and sisters in the Lord and to interact therein. And we look forward to next year. I guess it'll be in Virginia, a little bit closer to your neck of the woods. Actually not, because you're already in Tennessee. However, still not too far. And we're looking forward to the assembly there, and we'll see what's on deck. I'm sure in about 8 months, we'll have more podcast conversations and start to hear what's on the assembly's docket.
That's right. And since you brought up a sister podcast of the Presby Girls, if it's appropriate, if I might make a small plug for a new podcast effort that's going to be coming forth in the next few weeks. It's a joint effort of several PCA teaching elders, and it's called Larger for Life.
Yes.
It's a humble, modest effort, but it's a podcast that we hope to, it'll take us several years to get through. And it's as you might have intimated from the title, a podcast on the Westminster Larger Catechism. So there are several podcast efforts that we're aware of where folks are going through the confession. There have been several efforts where folks have gone through the shorter catechism, mm-hmm. But we haven't found quite as similar efforts to go through the larger catechism. And mm-hmm. so we hardly fancy ourselves experts, but we hope that it might be a useful resource for folks to get perhaps familiar for the first time with the wonderful resource that is the larger catechism, or maybe to be refreshed in it and find a newfound appreciation for it through our humble attempts.
Yeah, that's a noble endeavor. I encourage you in that. I did run into Stephen Spinnenweber. I ran into his mustache first, and then ran into him soon afterwards.
As is often the case, that's right.
But he gave me a card on the Larger for Life podcast. I'm looking forward to that. And I love the Larger Catechism, and we don't give it the respect. Well, we give it the respect, but we don't give it the time that it's due. And it's certainly a wonderful document, and we need to get in there. So I'm looking forward to hearing that and your conversation on it. But overall, thanks so much, Sean, for taking the time out of your day. We really appreciate you bringing to us such wonderful resources and information about John Knox. We look forward to growing in our knowledge and understanding of him as well. Certainly, there are a lot of applications and things for the present church, and we look forward to reading and hearing from you in the future on it. Thanks so much.
Glad to be here, Camden. Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. Let me point people to the various places that you need to go. Head on over to covenant-pca.com for information on the church where Sean serves as a minister, and you can find links in our episode description to many, if not all, of the things we've mentioned already in this episode, and visit us online as well at reformedforum.org. I know not everyone that listens to the podcast gets onto the website because they subscribe in their podcast app, whatever app that may be, but we have many resources available online and available for free, more than a dozen courses, video courses available for free. Most of them are suitable for adult Sunday schools, but we also have advanced materials in apologetics, Trinitarian theology, and other subjects. And of course, there are ways to get in touch with us. You can send us an email at mail@reformedforum.org or tweet us at Reformed Forum. I do want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.